Welcome to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Androscoggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Androscoggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I am joined by local talent, longtime friend, and our producer, Mark Turcotte.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome. Together, Mark and I explore how incredible people, the voices of Androscoggin, build, lead, and thrive while contributing to a better quality of life for all. So here's a little something fun that we have for our listeners today. Today, you are getting part entrepreneur, part community leaders, and 100% real authentic talent, because today, yeah. Our guests are each other. I'm super excited about this episode. I have spent years enjoying interviews with you on air, off air, live, in person, all kinds of fun settings.
Yeah.
And I love that, and I love to be able to have a conversation with you today. So it's not that we don't have a guest. I want to be really clear. It's not that we couldn't book the show. We booked each other.
We did. This is totally by design.
It is.
I looked at the guest calendar.
I love this moment.
I was on for today's date, and you have we for the next I don't know 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah, booked. No, we're booked out for months ahead.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to save a spot for us to connect, man.
Aww.
Just you and I, like
yeah.
The old days.
Yeah. Shanna, what is your favorite way to spend time in Androscoggin County?
Ooh, good question, good question. I mean, I would say my absolute favorite is if I can get in a camping trip in Androscoggin County, which I just found out that there is free camping in the Androscoggin Riverlands, I think. More to come, because I am in an investigative stage on this. But and I'm not scared. Like, I love a campground that has some amenities, but I'm not scared to, as long as I'm camping in a place where there's no one's going to come and kick me out and I'm not accidentally trespassing, I can do it pretty kind of low-key, low-tech, too. But the way, my favorite and most common way is probably what I would say to spend time. I love dining. I love, like, experiences and shared experiences with people over food. It's not just that I love food. Like, I love cooking and I love baking. But I really enjoy the opportunities to hang out with local chefs. Like, I mean, I spent 16 plus years in the hospitality industry. Like, sit me next to the kitchen. I want to hear 86. I want to hear that coming out of the back. Like, I love the environment. Yeah. I love the busyness of it. I love looking around the room and figuring out, like, who's celebrating what and who's having a hard conversation with somebody. And is that work or is that pleasure? Is that four generations in the corner? Like, I just think really amazing moments happen around tables, and it'd be really weird if I just showed up in people's kitchens. So, like, the only place I can get that is local restaurants. And I mean, I love, like, a good 4-course dinner with martini and a nice bottle of wine, but I am just as happy. And some days, depending on my mood, happier to sit at a diner and get, like, a really killer omelet with some nice home fries on the side. And my first job was at a, like, very kind of greasy spoon diner, truck stop side of the road place in Orland, Maine. It's no longer there. It was a place called Duffy's. And it was
what a great name for a diner.
Yeah, it was. I think it was like a, I don't know, like a shamrock holding leprechaun was the, like, I don't know, which is, like, it was not a very Irish population in Orland either. So I don't know where that comes from. But yeah, that's where I, like, cut my chops and had my first job. And so, yeah, I think really intimate moments play out in public settings. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe I'm a voyeur, but I think it's because I'm an empath. Like, I enjoy the different energy that comes off different tables. And servers are chameleons, and they're just incredibly, many at least, are incredibly skilled at, like, knowing what a table needs or not. And I just love, like, I don't know, shove me in the corner. And shove me in the corner with a good friend, and we will just laugh for 2.5 hours and soak it up. And so there's just no shortage of wonderful places to have a good meal and a good experience in Androscoggin County. So that is my most, because, you know, I eat more than I have time to go camping, like 3 meals a day versus one weekend a week. So, but those are my two.
Yeah. I loved when I was in the hospitality industry. I absolutely loved it. I was a bartender.
Yeah. Oh, of course you were.
At Marco's when it was on Lisbon Street.
Wow, when was that?
That was, let's see, that was in the mid-90s. It was there way before that.
Fun.
But I worked there in the mid-90s.
So does that Marco's, knowing what I know of Marco's, can you do like martinis, Manhattans, old?
I loved it while I was in there because you always, and you as a server know this, you always have an opportunity to make someone's day better.
Yeah.
When you're in hospitality.
That's my favorite part.
Yep.
And you know immediately how you're doing at your job. There is nothing like instant gratification. Like the latest that you know how well you did is when they leave the table and you see your tip, right? Like you know immediately, and you have the opportunity to turn your day around. You have the opportunity to turn their day around. Mm-hmm. I think it's just very gratifying and like instantaneous gratification. The projects that I work on now can take months to be realized, sometimes years to be realized.
Yeah.
I don't ever get to go home and be like, those things are done, tied with a bow, nailed it. I know how I did,
right.
Even if I don't feel like I did great or I feel like I you spend months in this in-between stage in my career and what I do now. And man, I used to love like going home being like, oh, I killed it tonight. Yeah. Or tonight was an off night. I didn't have a great attitude. That was reflected in my tips. Thank God tomorrow's a new day.
We'll get them
the
tomorrow.
The clean slateness of hospitality is, I miss that from time to time. What was your most hated drink order?
Well,
like,
the most,
God, that again.
The most hated, I think it was easy to make.
Yeah.
But
it
was just wrong.
Yes, that.
So we had a customer who would come in and order a Manhattan extra sweet. So the first time I made his drink, I put double the amount of sweet vermouth I would in any other Manhattan. Extra sweet, I'm just going to give him double. He sent it back twice because there wasn't enough sweet vermouth in it. And once I got to know him, more like 70-30 vermouth.
That's like the Dunkin' order when somebody's in front of you and gets like seven cream, seven sugar, half a teaspoon of coffee.
And as I'd be making his drink, I'm like, this is just so wrong.
Yeah.
It's so wrong.
But you know what my version of that is?
What?
A spritzer with ice. I'd like a red wine spritzer with ice. I don't even know what glass to serve that in.
Yeah.
By the time you've ordered that, I'm like, I can't put it in a wine glass. That seems sacrilege to, here's your ice cubes and your, I just can't.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your productivity hack. So we always ask guests, what's your go-to productivity hack when you're feeling overwhelmed? I know you talk about my schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You have a schedule. And what has always impressed me and amazed me with a hint of disbelief attached to the amazement is yours. I mean, my schedule is a lot of hours, but they're consecutive.
Yeah.
And you work this crazy split life of early and late. And so like, how do you make that work? And what's your productivity hack for the moments? And in the middle, you're doing... You design flyers and graphics and
Well, for the folks who don't know, I work full time at Lydia Media. We do a podcast every morning, the Lunch Bunch podcast. I also help out with the Uncle Andy's Digest and LA Metro Magazine and whatever else Pam needs. And I also work with you on this podcast, you know, a few times a month, which is awesome. I do stand-up comedy. I used to produce a lot of stand-up comedy. I don't anymore. I just perform now, which is so much better.
I was going to say, you just show up, do the fun part.
Oh, if I'd have known about this, if I'd known about this 10 years ago.
It's like the equivalent of people being like, grandkids are so great, I don't know why I bothered having children.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know that you could have gotten there without the other.
Yeah.
That's true.
At my busiest in comedy while still having a full-time job, I was doing close to 200 shows a year.
That's insane.
And putting over 15,000 miles a year on my car just for comedy.
Also insane.
Yeah. I chased it pretty hard.
Yeah.
And then COVID hit and it changed everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also do a lot of freelance work as well, whether it be audio or graphics or what have you. But
so the thing that
websites,
you left out...
Oh yeah, photography. Yeah, I do that too. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, you have some history. All of those things, but sports photography. And how much of that is because you're great and have a good camera, or because you love sports and know what shot to get? Because I think that's actually like you're a sports fan. You're an avid enjoy sports. You enjoy competition.
True.
Like there's some that you like more than others for sure, but you like sports. And I think fundamentally knowing what picture a sports fan wants to see is part of what your strength is with photography. Not that you're not good with camera, because you also are.
Yeah, like, thank you. But it's 50-50 in what you just said.
You think?
Because any photographer will tell you who has shot sports. you can't get a great sports photograph with amateur equipment.
Yeah, that's true.
You can't. We're working in poorly lit gyms.
High speed stuff.
You got to nail it.
Yeah.
So you need good equipment. And I've
so you're not out there with your iPhone. It does look like a long lens every time
I
see you.
Yeah, it's a long lens. And you know, when you're shooting basketball and hockey, you can get away with, you know, the mid range lenses. But now that the weather's getting nicer, we're going to have, you know, baseball and lacrosse and soccer and all that, and you need long lenses. If you're out there with a 35mm to 50mm lens shooting soccer, you're just not going to get anything.
So you ever shot track and field?
Yes.
How's that experience? I'm a track mom.
See, and
chaotic is a track.
Yeah, chaotic. What I love about track and field is there's always something going on.
Yeah, well, that's
on the
true.
Track. Yeah. That, so chaos. Usually when I freelanced for the Sun Journal, I would have assignments. I need to shoot this school or this kid. Or, yeah. So that was easy. I knew who to follow, when their events were, and all that. But if I'm just going there as a freelancer just to get some shots for, you know, social media or whatever,
yeah, it's, you're not bored.
No, you're never bored there. At track and field.
I laughed because I had been a football mom for like 6 or 8 years, and I went to my kid's first track meet, and I showed up, and like I know how the parenting relationships among parents is in different various sports, not just football. But so I found a parent, and I was like, hi, I'm a football mom. Mm-hmm. This is all new to me. Mm-hmm. Any advice as I try to, like, because the whole, you walk onto a track field and it's events going on everywhere and loudspeakers, yeah, and you, it seems like they're saying the same thing, but really they're saying like first call, second call, third, yep, call, final call,
yep,
for different events starting. And your advice was find your kid and follow them, mm-hmm, which, by the way, genuinely speaking, I would say is probably really good advice. Like now, like, yeah, you know, 4 years in, like, yeah, that serves you well.
Sure.
It was also my kid's first track meet. And so he, every time they called first, second, third, and final for each of the four events he was in, he went and checked in. I think I logged 6 miles trying to track my kid at that first track meet. So like, good advice once your kid knows what they're doing. Otherwise, right, just stand on the edge, man.
Yeah.
Stand on the edge. Maybe, yeah, with some binoculars, some good equipment, but.
And you don't realize the impact that those photos have, yeah, on the kids and the parents. Like, yeah, nobody cares that I'm out shooting at Hadlock Field. The Portland Sea Dogs are going to get whatever they need from their staff.
Yeah.
But when I'm at a high school game, I was hired to photograph the Lewiston High School girls soccer and girls lacrosse. I'd submit the photos saying, here you go. There's like 60 or 70 photos. And they're just like, oh my God, you can't, you know,
it's
and
so
they're sending
incredible.
Me comments from the,
yeah,
moms and the dads and all that. So you're like, and
it means a lot for the kids,
yeah,
too. And then it comes around to meaning a lot again during the, like, put to, like, we're asked to submit photos for senior slideshows,
yeah,
of the kids at different, and they get to see it and it's a good photo. And otherwise, you've got like a picture of your kid in their uniform in front of like a closet door at your house,
right,
that you're trying to.
Right, yeah.
Like, they are really impactful for,
yeah,
years to come. I can say that now because I've got like post high school graduates.
Right.
You are a jack of all trades. Like, it is incredible because I've seen your design work. I've seen you do social media. I've seen you do all kinds of aspects of marketing for yourself, for others, for projects you work on. For employment. Like, I mean, I've been with you a little while now,
sure,
6 years in,
yeah,
to me,
yeah,
which is, you know, a smidge of your overall professional history. But in that time, I've seen you just display a real breadth of skills and a willingness to use them all to bring it to whatever you're doing. Like, I've never once felt like you would be the guy who'd be like, well, but that's not what I do here.
Yeah.
Like, if it's,
yeah,
a skill you have,
right,
you're going to bring it to the table.
Of course. Yeah, that's helped me out quite a bit, and thank you for saying that.
Yeah,
I appreciate,
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I respect,
yeah, that's,
it.
That's helped me out with the Dempsey Center, Dempsey,
yeah,
Challenge, to help organize those events in the early years, like,
yeah,
the first three or four of them. And like working in radio, working at Lydia Media, I'm able to use,
yeah,
you know, whatever skill sets I've accumulated over the years. I didn't go to school for anything but photography, but
you went to school for photography.
I did.
I'll add,
yeah,
that to your bio when we come back to,
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I did. And that was in the mid-90s. But beyond that, I'm pretty much self-taught in everything. When I worked at Oxford Plains Speedway,
YouTube,
they needed a website. And I didn't. I had no idea.
Yeah, oh, add website.
They're just like, they're just like, hey, Mark, you know, I'd love to have a website.
Out.
And this was in 1997 when the internet was in its infancy,
yeah,
and there was no YouTube.
No, right.
And I had to figure that out.
One of your qualities that you just like put such a fine point to, quick turnarounds not only don't faze you, but it's your standard.
Yeah, I love deadlines. You just, know, we had Pam Ashby on here a few weeks ago, and she was talking about how she loved deadlines, and I do as well. Never went to school for any of this stuff, but I had confidence enough to figure out that I'd be able to do it with, you know, give me a few days, give me a few shots at it, and I'll get it.
That's an entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah.
That's like, I don't know if you've ever thought of yourself or self-described yourself as like a serial entrepreneur, but you are, and you have very much an entrepreneurial spirit. The, like, both the commitment to like figure it out, mm-hmm. push through it,
yeah.
commitment to self-learning. I know really intelligent people who are highly educated and degreed, and they don't get the advantages that come from the stick with itness and the quickness that you and others who like have that spirit. Mm-hmm. It is such a differentiator for people who like have quick career growth trajectories. This, you know, there's, I see really, you know, well-degreed people sitting back and being like, well, when somebody asked me to, and like, if you don't have initiative, man, then you, that is something you have in spades.
Oh, thanks. And it doesn't always work to my benefit.
No.
I am not.
I understand that personally. Yeah. I like get that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my goals years ago, I decided that I wanted to create a life that I didn't need a vacation from.
Yeah. And I think about that a lot. You've said that before, and it sticks with me.
I think to this point, I've done it, but there are drawbacks as well. I'm not earning the money I know I'm capable of earning.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm also not motivated by money.
Well, what is that? I don't know if it's a parable or a fable, but like the, you know, the really rich guy who's on the, went to a foreign land, is on a beach, sees a fisherman, talks to him, and is like, well, so what's your gig? And the guy's like, oh, I fish a couple hours a day. And, you know, and then that's it. And he's like, well, if you pushed yourself, you could buy a second boat. And if you bought a second boat, you would. And he describes this whole process. And at the end of it, he gets to like, cool, so I've done all of those things. And what's the payback? Well, you could sit here on the beach. And he's like, bro, that's what I'm doing.
Yes, yeah.
And I think about that a lot. Because I'm a pretty like take initiative driven mm-hmm. person too. But it does, I mean, it comes at, I love everything I do. It's, you know, I think the like, if you love your job, then you'll never work a day in your life. Mm-hmm. That's real for me. But man, I can't say I don't need a vacation. That is very different.
Yeah.
So I can appreciate that. Every time you say that, write in, write hard.
Yeah.
Like, oh, gut punch. Yeah, but nice reminder.
There's yin and yang to all of that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've never wanted to be motivated by, I've always taken lessons from people that I've worked with throughout the years. I've known exactly what I didn't want to do, the person I didn't want to become.
Yeah.
And
some of our best teachers are the people who teach us what we aren't going to be, how we're not going to do it. I've learned some really valuable lessons mm-hmm. in my life that way. Painful ones, but but boy, did it make me good. Like, I'm like, oh, that's the flip side of it.
Right.
I'll just go be the other part of what I'm not doing.
And I remember I was at a job that I had just given my notice to, and a day passed, and the next day they came into my office and they offered me a boatload more money. And my first thought was, where was that while I was, you know, here for the past 4 years?
Yeah.
And I turned it down, and it was such a liberating feeling. Mm-hmm. It's like, I can't be bought. That's one thing I know about myself, is I can't be bought.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah, I pushed. And the thing is like, I, you know, for folks who don't know my story, I grew up in rural poverty. And then for a time when my kids were really young, lived, you know, in urban poverty, and two very different experiences. I'm not going to say like one's better or worse than the other, but the resources and the support network, very fundamentally different between the two. And so I'm not motivated by money. I am motivated by security.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right?
Big difference there.
And it took me a minute in my own growth to understand there was a difference. Yep. And that same lesson came with the, security is vital, particularly because I'm a parent. I'm responsible mm-hmm. for other humans. There is risks I would take, and, you know, lifestyle standards that I would be willing to do that I would never subject my children to. Mm-hmm. I lived for an entire summer in a camper when I was in college. Would I raise my kids in a camper? No, right? But like, I would do that again if I didn't have kids. Yeah, like, sure, absolutely. Maybe in the future.
Yeah.
So there is something about security that I'm mindful of, but, you know, I learned what what actually being secure looks like. And that, you know, extra financial resources is awesome at easing that burden and giving you a sense of security. But it's not necessary. You don't need a ton of disposable income to feel secure. And I'm not minimizing, you know, those who struggle to feel secure. It is a hard world.
Of course.
To get your basic needs met yep. right now. So please don't misunderstand. But I had relative security. And I threw it all away for values that I couldn't part with. That became a really clear moment for me where I was like, I can't be bought. Yeah. There is no price tag yeah. to buying this out. Like my peace of mind, sleeping at night and being the kind of parent I'm proud for my children to know who I am, there is no compromise
right.
for that for me. And that's a very different thing, right? Like price tag versus security, very yeah. different thing.
And when you can pass that along to your kids.
And I have.
It's magical.
It's yeah. super cool for them to be yeah. old enough for me to be like, that lesson hit.
Yep.
It's so good. Yep. My kids are old enough for me to know how quickly this has gone already, that I don't want to rush mm-hmm. what little time is left. Mm-hmm. I have officially 3 20-year-olds, so the twins wow. just turned 20
yeah.
This past weekend, and then an 18-year-old, who, well, technically he'll be 18 in a week. You know, I'm so close that I don't want to wish these last couple of years away. I know that right. time is going to go fast, and then I can fully appreciate that there will be this whole stretch of my life still yet to experience where...
Yeah.
I can spend the summer in a camper if I want to. Like, there's nothing,
that's
you know,
right.
there's so many decisions that I've made around consistency, routine, and security that are things that I would absolutely negotiate for the right experience or, you know, to live aligned with my beliefs. Like, yeah, I would totally switch some things up. So,
yeah
I look forward to that. I don't want to rush it. There was a point in my life where I was like very, very much desiring the next stage to come a little bit quicker. And in fairness, if you had 3 kids in diapers at once, you might have felt the same way.
I probably would. Yeah. Yeah.
You might have felt the same way.
When you get to the point where the kids are outnumbering the parents.
Which was immediately
yeah,
for me.
Yeah,
I mean, almost immediately.
Right.
My first birth was twins.
Yep.
And the twins were 4 when I started single parenting. And so I had 4-year-old twins and a 2-year-old.
Wow.
Like, I mean, they could separate, and who are you gonna follow? Which one are you gonna chase to keep out of the road or whatever,
right.
out of the candy jar, whatever direction they're headed in? I was outnumbered immediately. So my whole life has been a game of math, and like, yeah, it's fine.
I don't know if we answered the question.
Yeah, did we need to though?
I don't think so.
You did answer yours.
Short answer is I go for a walk to get away from it.
Oh,
yeah. I need just to clear my head, and then I'll come back to it.
Nice.
If I can sense myself getting frustrated yeah. and I think the work is taking way longer than it should,
yeah, yeah.
I'll just go for a walk.
We call that hitting the wall around here
yeah.
at the office.
Yeah.
Like, it's not unusual to come out for us to come mm-hmm. into like our shared space and be like, I've hit the wall.
Yeah.
Go change your scenery, move your body.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's an unsticking hack. I don't know that it makes... I mean, technically, I guess it makes me more productive, but I do love that one.
Yeah.
So I set timers. I set timers and alarms. For yeah. me, I don't know how to describe it. My mental load is always heavy, right? And it's mm-hmm. Am I prepared for the 6 meetings that I have tomorrow?
Right.
Is dinner defrosted? Will I be able to cook it because I have those 6 meetings in a 30-minute time frame? Or is somebody else covering dinner? You know, is the insurance renewing yet? Like, the load, the mental workload is significant, both inside of work and out. And it is not like your brain keeps 2 separate lists and is like, oh, I've clocked out. It's 5:30. I'll switch to the parent mental load.
Right?
Like, yeah. you are thinking yeah. about, is the roof tiles coming up? You know, while you're in workspace, and then at 10:30 at night,
yeah.
you're laying in bed being like, oh, how's that 3 p.m. meeting prep tomorrow?
Right.
And so for me, my biggest issue that like bogs me down from a productivity perspective is that mental workload. Like, how much of it is buzzing in the background, and how is that noise keeping me from being able to execute the task in front of me or be really invested in the conversation that I'm in? And so I offload. For me, yeah. the only way that I can get something to come off that list, that like constant mental buzz in the background, is for me to be secure and confident that I have set it down in a way I don't have to think about it,
mm-hmm.
and that it will come back to me at the time that I need to think about it. So it is everything from sending myself timed emails, setting really, if anyone ever took a screenshot of my alarms on my iPhone and the names of all my alarms and the very random times they are, you would understand all that much more about my inner workings. But it, for me, it's that, like, what is it that's in the back of my head that I can't let go? And then how do I, like, make an intentional point of putting it down and knowing that I don't have to worry about it because it's going to come back to me? That's my biggest productivity hack, which really, I don't know if that's a hack because it looks like 20 different things, but that's the way I get it done. That's the way I, like, move forward.
If it works.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I just use timers on the task because when I dig into something, like you, I guess your version of this might be like maybe writing new material, but probably more like designing, like when you're in a software program and you're designing something and then all of a sudden 3 hours has gone by. I set timers for that kind of project, whether it's a writing project or I set a timer to be like, okay, at an hour and 20 minutes, like I'm just going to stop. Should I be done by now? Am I going down a rabbit hole? I'm not William Shakespeare. It's a handbook. Is it gonna need to be that polished? Like, and sometimes I just need an external reminder. So
sure.
Timers and reminders in general. All kinds of weird ones.
I make the mistake of trusting myself that I'll remember to do certain things.
See, I used to do that.
Yeah.
That's why this is my hack. It's like, that was my problem.
Sometimes it comes back to bite
me. Yeah. Well, particularly if it's a task you really enjoy, right? And I'm fortunate that there's so many things I do that I do really enjoy that you can lose a day if you're not careful.
True.
And it's not that you regretted the way you spent your day. You regretted you don't have 2 days to do the other things you should have been doing in that day, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Timers. That's the stuff that I love. All right, we've touched on this a little bit, but I'm going to pull this thread a little bit further.
Okay.
Okay. So in the 6 years, which sometimes feels like I've known you my whole life, and I love that about
it. It kind of does, yeah.
Yeah. And every once in a while, I try to be like, where did it start? What was that moment like? And then I'm like, no, he's always been there, and I love that. I don't need a starting point. Like, maybe I knew you in different ways before I even knew that I knew you. And I sometimes wonder that. Yeah, I mean, with your resume, really could be. I could have been seeing your names in photo credits and papers.
True.
So I don't try to figure out when you entered my world.
Okay.
I just embrace the cognizant part that I get to enjoy with intention. And though I came to you, met you, and have started spending time with you in the relationship of radio, you were still doing comedy at that time. You introduced me to your comedy. I went to your comedy, and I knew you as a comedian outside of also being a radio personality. Mm-hmm. And in those years, learning, sometimes piecing together, sometimes asking probing questions, I have learned not only did you like find your way to stand-up and writing and creating and performing stand-up, you were doing that and found that to be challenging in a place where there wasn't a lot of venues, there wasn't a big scene. And, you know, as you've mentioned, there was a lot of miles being put on your car so that you could go to where comedy could be done. I'm curious, and, you know, tell our listeners at home, but like the transition moment where you're like, all right, damn it, I'm just going to build up the comedy scene here, and where you not only performed, but you also started booking. And I think I've seen the impact. I've talked to other people, sometimes in the room with you, sometimes not at all, where people have talked really honestly about how you got them in, they got bit by the bug because being exposed to you or going to a show, and you have grown this scene here, you know, and even if it's accelerating under new stewardship and leadership, I know that those seeds were seeds that you like planted and watered and sunshined with your love for years. And so tell me a little bit about that moment and help me fill in all the gaps. Because when did it start?
I started comedy late in life. I've been fascinated with stand-up since I was 12 years old. I saw George Carlin.
I was going to say, who were you listening to?
It was
to?
George Carlin on HBO. And he wasn't a lot of people think of Carlin now like the angry philosopher that he was in his later years. But this was like Carlin at Carnegie when he was still doing a lot of wordplay and things like that. And I was just absolutely fascinated by it. And I said, someday I'm going to do that. And then someday turned into 30 years later.
That's wild.
Yeah. So I never knew how to get started. And like, how do you become a comedian? Are you anointed? What happens?
Great question.
Yeah,
all the way around.
So I had
maybe
no
an open
idea.
Mic? I don't know. Like, and you can't just go. You got to prepare before you go.
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise you're going to have a really bad time.
I just thought these folks were really good when they stood up at the open mic. You guys prepare for those open mics.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
And if
that
you
now.
Don't, it's obvious.
Yeah. Also that. Also that.
So I took a comedy workshop. I took a stand-up comedy workshop in Portland. And 15 minutes in, I said, this is all I need. I knew it.
Yeah.
It introduced me to the Portland scene. I knew where the open mics were. I knew who was booking shows, even though at that time I had no business being near any kind of lineup that was on any kind of paid show. But that's, I knew, like, that's where the light bulb went off, where this is exactly what I
need. You love it as much as your 12-year-old self
thought
you would.
Yeah, it's like, this is how you become a comedian. So there was an open mic on Thursday nights in Portland called Slancha. Great bar. I think it's a video game bar right now.
Cool.
But back then, my sister and I used to go. My sister took the course as well. And we used to go to Slancha every Thursday. Every Thursday without fail. And it was a rough room. Like, Slancha, the...
Like, they'd throw stuff at you.
No, they wouldn't throw stuff at you. But they would give you about 20 to 30 seconds. And if they felt that you were not going to make them laugh, it's back to the conversations, back to, doing whatever you were doing. But
I gave you a shot.
They'd give you a shot, yeah. Which was great. But that's where your skin gets thick.
Yeah.
That's where you learn how to write a good joke to hold their attention. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't have asked for a better teacher than the open mic at Slancha, and we don't have anything like that now.
Yeah.
And this is going to sound weird, but I truly believe it. I believe the current comedy scene, way too supportive.
You want a little more heckling?
Not heckling.
Okay.
I'm a big fan of tough love in comedy. If you need to put more work in, you need to be told that by someone who has a few years on you.
Do you give that gift to folks?
I try to, in the nicest way I can.
And like... Because aside.
Yeah, and they do like if,
not while they're on stage.
If they no,
God, no. You need more practice.
No, but if they come up and ask for advice, I will gladly give it to them. And if I feel I have something that I can offer to benefit them, I will send them a message or whatever. Hey, just an idea. When I was 2 years into comedy, I wrote a list of about 15 to 20 things that I wish comedians would stop doing on stage.
Oh, fun. Give me two.
Yeah. Okay.
Give me two.
When you are the fifth comedian in the show, you go up to the microphone and your first words are, hey, how's everybody doing tonight? Well, they've already answered that question five times.
That's a really good one.
Yeah.
That's
please a really stop. Good one. Please. Yeah. I'm a big fan of just going up to the microphone and starting your set.
Yeah.
You don't need the audience's approval to start.
Yeah. And they're there. They're sitting down. That's the approval.
Yeah. And the other one kind of piggybacks on this one is... You're asking questions throughout your entire set. Like, oh, I have a joke about dogs. Hey, who likes dogs out here? It's like you're asking them for permission for you to tell your joke.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. What if nobody likes dogs? Are you still going to tell the joke? So a lot of wasted time and energy on stage.
Energy. So for the audience, that's exhausting.
The audience,
I'm a supportive audience member. Like, I take it very seriously. Yeah. They're like... If you're going to ask me a question as an audience, I'm going to be the person who answers it so that it's not just silence.
Exactly.
I'm going to be that person.
Right. Yeah.
And man, don't make me stay that vigilant every 20 seconds.
Right.
It really does pull on the energy.
Learn how to read the room.
So your 20 things is a little like pet peeves.
Pet peeves.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this, it didn't go viral, but it's on my website and it made the rounds and a comedian in Las Vegas shared it.
Because it's a good list.
On his profile.
It's a gift for everybody if people would start to pay attention to that.
Yeah, so I said, let's just, and I think the opening paragraph was, here's just some things I was thinking of that we could all try to do to make the stage a better place.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's make comedy better. Because you mentioned, the torch has been passed. Leonard Kimball and Great Falls Comedy Club is doing a fantastic job. Leonard is a much better businessman than I ever was. Because
you were trying to create show opportunities so you could just tell.
Not only that, I was trying to create opportunities for myself and other comics, but I was also trying to expose this area to stand-up comedy, and I wanted it to be great. I want your first experience when you're coming to see local comedy to be, I need to do this again. Where has this been all my life?
I
print out a sheet of paper for every show with the lineup, how much time you were doing, and a couple of things underneath. Please don't bring notes on stage. And the last one would be respect the audience. to me, respecting the audience, number one, is starting on time.
Yeah.
Because a lot of our audience members hired a babysitter so they could go out and have a good time. That. And a lot of shows, 8 o'clock start time, and by 8:45, we're like, all right, you guys want to do this? If my show had an 8 o'clock start time and it was 8:05 and nobody was on stage, you were getting an explanation.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. You know, we're 5 minutes late.
That's how I run my meetings,
yep,
too.
We're just waiting for one more.
How can I bring your comedy into my meeting so it's just funny? Yeah. It's just funnier. Yeah. Let's do that. Let's collab on that.
Yeah, but that was huge to me.
Yeah.
It's like, we are nothing without these people who came to see us.
Yeah.
And some comics, like, if there's a light audience, if there's like 10 people in the audience, they're like, oh, geez, you know, we're doing a show for 10 people. I'm like, these people came to see you.
Yeah.
If you want to get mad at anyone, go outside to the people who aren't here.
Yeah.
Right? That. Don't take it out on them. Oh, give them the really, best show they've ever had.
Really good point.
Yeah. I never understood that.
I love that. So what is your legacy? You have passed the torch. You are still reaping the benefits of a community that is exposed to and appreciates. You've got kids who are older.
Yeah.
You know? They're at a corner bar at an open mic night. Some raging party of an open mic night in Androscoggin County 15 years from now. And they hear their dad's name tossed around.
I think in this area, it will, you know, definitely be my contributions to the comedy scene.
Yeah.
When I started, there was nothing in Lewiston, Auburn.
Right.
It was, if you want to do comedy, you went to Portland and then heard about other shows in surrounding areas and, you know, hit those up. But there was nothing in Lewiston, Auburn, and that always bothered me. So I'm like, why not?
I love that. I have no doubt that'll be your legacy. I grew up in community, not just like in a community, but I had close-knit community related to the church that I was in and the youth group that I was in and related to Girl Scouts. And, you know, I grew up in a small town. And so, like, community to me isn't bounds of geography or even, you know, the things that we have in common. It's more like the things we share in common that we value, mm-hmm. build community. And as I learned more about you over the years, and that always just, you know, I've built community in so many different places around so many different principles, but I know what it takes to build community. I know the organizing and the relentless efforts and the up and down cycle of like, we're getting traction and things are gelling and this is coming together. And then, like, you know, there's just a series of small things that make it feel like maybe it's all falling apart and you don't walk away. You kind of recommit and reinvest in those moments. And those cycles are endless in number, right? Like, I know all of that firsthand. And as I witness you building this community and what you had already built by the time I entered into it, which I got to watch my kids experience their first comedy show. And
that
moment that you talked about, like, I watched my children have that. And I know how it is something they still reflect on and that it's still something that they value and that it built like a permanent love for a very specific type of performing arts for them. Yeah, and so, like, I've always respected that about you, and I have no doubt that's going to be part of your legacy.
Well, let's talk about your legacy.
Okay. Go on.
I don't even think we're halfway there yet.
Yeah, oh, No, it's funny. I don't say that. I say that because I reflect on this, as I already have in this episode with you, right? Like, I reflect on this so often to so many other people. There was this moment. I was waiting tables in my like journey to this point and to where I am in my career currently. There was this moment where I knew like I was never going to get healthcare waiting tables, that my knees were going to blow out by the time I was 50. Like, there's just some real stuff about that industry that like I'd do it every day if the knee replacement surgery came with no downtime and full benefits, right? I miss it. But there was this point where I knew that I had to transition to like, you know, the like a real job or like a white collar job or a job with benefits and a retirement plan, like just some basic things. And I had no idea what that looked like for me at the time. I knew that I needed to be thoughtful about it. I had, you know, 3/4 of my bachelor's degree under my belt, but had like had twins, ended up in the hospital, you know, on bed rest in my final year of college, and then took a 12-year hiatus from school because, you know, twins and they're hard and childcare is expensive. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you wake up and it's a decade later and you're like, oh, right, this wasn't my plan. And now you're not planning for your future. You're at you know, 10 years have gone by and you're planning for a future that starts at this point and not the point that you planned your future from. And so I had this real moment where I was like, what does it look like for me to stop doing this and do something else? Knowing that, like, again, the only thing I really, really, like, bare minimum needed was security. Like, I had a lot of college credits in economics, policy, environmental management, land use planning, you know, and like, what does that look like? Can I even work in that field if I don't have my degree yet? Like, what is that? So there was this moment, and I started working as a public health promotional professional, which I like maybe even specialist E2 or something, because my employer and the way they titled positions. But there was this moment in time where I was working 40 plus hours a week in a salary job at like $16 an hour. And this was 2012. So like, friends, do your own math. But like, it was good. It was above minimum wage, but it was not a high salary. And I went from working 5 nights a week to 3 nights a week while working this full-time job. And that tax year that I was, you know, having these two jobs and the salary and the benefits, and look at me, I had a 401k account, I made about $12,000 less in my annual tax return that year to work, you know, 30, 40 hours a week more collectively than I had been before. And there was this real moment of like, what, I mean, there was a million moments, honestly, in that year, but there was this real moment of like, this sacrifice is for that greater security and these other things, because I could do this for forever and make more money waiting tables, but like, I physically won't be able to do it for forever. Yeah. And so there was this real moment, and I've always known that I wanted to serve in public office, to run for an elected seat someday. I think there's great impact that you can have with policy, and I love direct work. I love developing leaders and watching what they're able to do as like the, you know, as the follow behind of a touch point that you had in their lives. I think there's lots of ways to have impact, and I do think that I often kind of self-calculate what I want to spend my time doing, what choices I'm going to make based on the opportunity to have the greatest impact, both by scale and by like great and not bad, right? Like great, the greatest impact. And so I had known for a long time that I wanted to run for public office. And there was this moment in that year where I'm working 70 hours a week and I'm doing everything I can for this future that is secure, that takes care of my babies, that helps me afford college for them, and that, like, you know, make sure my knees don't blow out. And at the same time, you know, I'm killing myself doing it. I'm seeing my kids less. I'm working an obscene amount of hours. And this current state representative and elected official that I liked and respected came to me and said, hey, I term out, and I'd love to talk to you about that goal that you have. And essentially just kind of like laid at my feet this opportunity that was everything I'd ever wanted, that you know, and I really struggled with, like, do I move forward with it? And how awful is it for me to not? How awful is it for me to walk away from this goal? What does that say about me? Am I walking away from my dream, this opportunity? And I actually just had this conversation with a close friend who's like at an interesting career point themselves too. But I just had this moment of being like, I'm nowhere near done. There's so much life left. There's so much more ahead of me. And no, not now isn't no, not ever. And that moment just helped me just stretch the time horizon of what my future could hold, how many years, decades, opportunities, pathway choice points, and all of the different wiggle pathways that lead from that there. It just made really clear to me that, like, I mean, I was 32 years old, and I look back now, I'm like, oh, such a baby. But, you know, I had my own babies, and I was, like, older, you know, relative to when I was 15 and went out on my own, like, I was twice as old. So, and time is so relative, right? And so it was just this really clear moment where I recalculated what life, what goals, and what legacy meant. And so, yeah, I'm nowhere near done, right? Like, I'm 44. I regularly say to people, and particularly for women, I think struggle with like aging and what it means to age and what society thinks of women who are aging. And I mean, you'll catch me in the mirror, like pulling on the skin by my eyes, like any other girl, don't get me wrong. But I don't hold a lot of like feelings towards that. It's just like, oh, look, this is a new way that I've changed. Oh, look at these new silver streaks. What proof of another step in my life, right? Like, I don't resent it. I don't regret it. But I often will say to people, like, oh, I can't wait to start my, like, next stage, my next career at 55. Like, I can't, like, there's a whole decade to 12, a dozen years from 55 on, right? It's like more than a decade from where I am right now. Yeah. There's another whole 10 to 12 years before I even reach retirement age that I could live this whole life. And I've only been doing what I've been doing now for 20. And I've lived, you know, three different versions of myself already. So, like, I can't wait to see what that is. I think who is telling, like, I hope the legacy that my family remembers. I hope when my, like, great-grandkids are hanging out with my grandkids and, you know, I'm a picture on the mantelpiece at that point, I hope that they talk about the way this family broke some, like, hard generational cycles, and that they point back to, like, and it was whatever they call it, Gigi, I don't know, what, yeah. Who am I going to be? But, like, that was the parent that broke some of these cycles for our family and allowed us to write a healthier, more secure story. And she did it with joy. Mm-hmm. Like I really hope that's the legacy that my family tells. I don't know that I see, like, a school or a library with my name on it or anything wild like that. But I think that there will be pockets of community, and in the ways that we've talked about community through this whole episode, but I think there'll be pockets of community who I hope say, like, you know, that block is better because of this work that was related to this work that she did.
Yeah.
This, you know, our community is stronger, and maybe that's a community of different bonds or values is stronger. I hope that's the legacy and impact that I have, that, like, lives were improved in some small but meaningful way. And the variety of ways that my life has been improved by other people and small decisions and large decisions in my, you know, already 44 years, I know what a small thing can be to someone else. And so, yeah, I hope that's the story that gets told about me.
What are you most proud of that you've accomplished with the chamber?
Ooh, I think moving the chamber and its members' mindsets to a place that is relevant with 2025 thinking, 2025 operations, 2025 community, like our business owner community looks different, acts different, has different needs now. And I think that this chamber in the last 5 years, you know, I know people who go to, with all love to my peers in the chamber industry, but, like, I know people who go to other chamber events and have the experience that you had in those rooms where no one says hello. Right. They're obviously the new person. And those people will come up and say, like, I travel outside of my area and visit not my local chamber and come here because I want to do business with these people. Because when I come to these events, I actually take away something valuable and I felt welcomed and seen. And I just think that's really powerful to like shift the foundational pieces of what this chamber is and what it's doing. And I'm really proud of our economic development work, like in so many kind of ways that those strings get out into the work that we do. And oftentimes it's not under the name or brand of the chamber that we're doing some of that work. And some of the stuff that I'm like the most proud of, and goes back to, like, maybe organizationally as a leader, I should have more of an ego for the work and the, because I don't subscribe to that enough. Mm-hmm. And I know as somebody who gives this advice to others regularly, like, you should be messaging that. You should be touting that work. And, but yeah, just, you know, fundamentally, Strength in LA is a program that, you know, kind of in my process of coming to the chamber, I had very concrete conversations about some work that I thought was missing, some gaps in our county, and the role the chamber and its foundation could play to address those gaps. And, you know, for me, that was Strength in LA, and it was built on other work that was already existing, but felt disconnected from the chamber. And I had been engaged in that work outside of this role. So had buy-in and the ability to move pretty quickly at growing that work and, you know, using the chamber as a vehicle to grow that work in very collective ways with so many other people. So it's not mine. It's hard for me to answer a question about, like, what I'm the most proud of because I don't own it. It's not mine. It's so shared, the work. But Strength in LA served more than 90 people in 2024, and the average salary increase of the career seekers was $37,000 a year.
Wow.
That moves somebody out of poverty.
Wow.
You know, buys school shoes for their kids, yeah. And And like, as you heard me say, I remember those moments. I know what it was to be on the cusp of that. That's incredible. And at the same time, I can say, you know, dozens of employers are one step closer to having their labor needs met because of that same work that offered those wages to those folks. And so I'm super proud of that.
Yeah.
And like, you don't see that on my website with the, like, Strength in LA has its own website. Right. We're proud partners of Strength in LA. Their employees are my teammates, and I love them and the work that they do and the impact that they have. And it's those things that, like, I don't expect anyone someday to be like, oh, this idea Shanna had and brought to, and but like, yeah, I don't think that'll ever be the story that gets told. And I don't need it to be.
Yeah, but it could be.
Yeah, someone like you is looking on YouTube at old documentaries from the 2020s and finds this episode is like, wow, that's, yeah, maybe. But like, and that does, it's not what drives me, right? Like I sleep great at night knowing that I get to be part of this work and that this work has amazing impact on real people. And like, that's what keeps me going.
Yeah. And through it all, you managed to raise some great kids as well, which is a whole other ballgame.
Thank you. I do have amazing children and young men now, but they'll always be my children. And I'm proud of them and I love them. And I remember, like, so parenting is just like the worst case of delayed gratification ever, right? Like, you have no idea if what you're doing is going to work. If it did work, did you spend a decade hoping that lesson stuck before it? Like, that's just what parenting is. And I was young. I was like 29, maybe 30. And I was doing a lot of activities in community. My work had me like organizing community and having community meetings and hosting community meetings. I brought my kids everywhere. Yeah. Part of that was the function of like, I was poor and my like real paid work required sitters. And I put my sitter dollars into the ROI that came from like going to a paid job. So my kids came to everything. And they used to say like, Mom, is tonight's meeting the one with pizza or the one with the where we have to sit quietly? And like, you know, no, it's the community meeting, not the city council meeting, right? Like, and I remember people being really critical, you know, in that narrative of women who are never present enough but are also not out of the house enough earning their, like, that whole narrative that parents in general, but women in particular, do have to face. I face that. And I remember someone saying to me, I don't know how you manage to do all the things you do and are okay with doing that instead of parenting. Yeah, shots fired, right? And
wow.
And like, and the thing was, is I just never thought of it that way. Yeah. First of all, like, I didn't think that was a criticism. There's things that I have done that I understand that in some circles could be criticized. This, like, that was not one of them. Mm-hmm. And I just remember looking at that person and saying, oh, that's not what I do instead of parenting. That's how I'm parenting. Yep. That's how I'm teaching about civic engagement. That's how I'm teaching about flag ceremonies. That's how I'm teaching about public duty and sense of duty. That's how I'm teaching about welcoming others and other languages. And like, this is how I teach. And this is how they're learning. And then I went home that night. I was like, shit, I really hope I'm right. I really hope I'm right. I hope that someday I can look back at this and be like, that worked out all right. Yeah. And I can, like, I took my 20-year-old to a school safety meeting last night at a school that he hasn't been in 10 years because he cares about this community and he cares about education and he hopes to educate his kids in this community where he hopes to make a home and a family. And he had great analysis after the meeting over dinner, was able to, like, really engage with, you know, what had happened there. And so, because they are really great, they are genuinely great kids, they actually have been able to at many points articulate things to me that show, you know, that hypothesis was right and that those moments paid off and that it stuck. And yeah, it never felt like a choice, right? Yeah. Like it felt like a both. This is how. I'm not going to sit at home and read values books about trust in government and then turn the page and read another one like, let's go see what government looks like.
Right.
Let's go vote together. Let's check out a city meeting. Let's, you know, go to an art fair and talk to artisans. Like, let's do all the things and learn about life through doing the things and then making sense of it together and talking about the questions that we have. And, you know, and they've gotten really good at, like, I have a question, but I'm sure it's the kind I'm supposed to wait until we're in the car to ask. And I'm like, yes, if you think so, definitely is. 100%.
Trust yourself.
That's situational awareness, right?
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that about
Oh, absolutely.
Because they really are great.
Yeah.
They're amazing young men.
Yeah. And that brought back some memories, too, of when I was, when our kids were young, Sherry was working 10 to 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
So I had the kids, and I would take them on photo assignments with me.
Yeah.
I would take them, if I had a clean comedy show, I would take them
Necessity,
to the
man.
Show. Yeah. And it just gives them a different perspective.
They're better humans
on their
because
parents.
Of it.
They become better humans. Yeah. They see how you interact in public, they see how you treat people outside of the family.
Yeah.
And yeah, it has a lasting impact.
And they appreciate you as a whole person.
Yeah.
Like I, good, bad, or ugly, I remember the moment that I realized that my mom was not just a mom. She was a daughter. She was a sister. Mm-hmm. She was a troop leader. She was an employee. Like I remember very clearly being like, oh, A, how selfish am I to have thought she only does this one thing for me and that I, like her whole, I'm her son. The
yeah.
whole world revolves around
yeah.
me. But kids don't get to learn that unless you show them that and
right.
you show up vulnerable. And, you know, like I put myself in timeout almost as much as I put the kids in timeout. Like I owned when I needed a minute mm-hmm. to calm down or I needed mm-hmm. to recenter. I owned when I owed them an apology. That has made them very emotionally mature and self-aware and capable in ways that I don't often see adults able to moderate their emotions, their responses. So I, you know, my kids listen to these podcasts, so they always try to be thoughtful. This is not a surprise to them. I didn't want kids. I didn't think I was going to have kids. I'm not sad that I do. I love them. They are maybe the best thing I've ever done. And my best opportunity to have meaningful impact comes from the fact that there's these four amazing humans that are going to change the world in their own ways. And that is maybe some of the best work that I will leave behind
sure.
is these humans, right?
Yeah.
And, but I didn't want it and I didn't expect it and I didn't think I'd be capable and I wasn't certain how I would go about it. And, you know, all things said and not done at all, pretty happy with the way things have shaked out.
Yeah.
Like, I enjoy spending time with my kids. Like, I have a blast with them. We had a blast at that show where they're like football players in the stands whooping up for the tap dancing
yeah.
and singing on the stage.
That's
like,
great.
We have fun together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
Zero
what
regrets.
It's all about. Decades from now, chances are you're not going to be saying, I wish I spent more time at the office.
No way.
You're going to look at those boys and be damn proud of what you've
yeah.
done. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's what most of my, like, kind of your, I think other people have this. Maybe this is one of those things that, like, am I the only one that does that? Maybe I am. But, like, you know, there's an internal, I don't know if it's a person or a scale or a flow chart that you use, but I think each of us have this set of things inside us that we orient our choices around, you know, column values, whatever you want. But for me, can I own what I did today and look my kids in the eyes and be proud and tell the story of what my choices were today? You know, for others, it's their faith. And like, I do believe like I'll have to reckon to a greater power
mm-hmm.
and, but man, I've got a long time. Hopefully, I've got a long time before that. And like, my kids are present. I have to reckon with them every single day. And
right.
that has always been just like a key decision-making school and kind of, it's my internal compass of how
yeah.
I orient my way through sticky, yucky moments that we inevitably come into as humans and as adults. And I think I am better for them being in my life. And not the other way around, though I certainly hope I have had good influences in their life. But
they tend to keep your priorities in order
yeah.
as well,
yeah,
which is huge. Yeah. I was told if you put your family first, you will never have to question your priorities.
That, right? Just fundamentally that.
Yeah.
And it's quality, not quantity. I know plenty of people who spend all of their time with their children, and that is not the same.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah.
It is not the same,
yeah.
sir. It's not the same.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a lot of years left to do a whole bunch of different things. And
yep.
I think, like, you know, what are the things I can do to make sure they, like, when I talk about economic development, when I talk about, you know, job creation, when I talk about supporting small businesses, like, there's a whole bunch of really good, like, I'm an economist. I have some good rationale for that. Like, I you know, point to numbers and stuff, and I've got charts. I love
mm-hmm.
a good bar chart. But fundamentally, I'm, like, trying to create the community that I want my kids to stay in, to choose to be in, where they'll have economic opportunity and they'll be able to provide for a family. And I want them to do that here, selfishly, because I don't want to have to move halfway across the country so that I can be in the country, in the community that they chose.
Right.
Right. Like, let's make this place exactly the place that they want to be, you know? And so there's always been a really tight linkage between how I raise my kids and what I want from my parenting experience with what I want from my professional time and my work and, you know, the schedule that I keep and the gray lines that I walk across and the boards that I serve on, that, like, which Shanna is showing up? Is it like work Shanna? And like, am I paid? Am I not paid? I, you know, whatever. Because, like, fundamentally, yeah, I'm pretty much driving for the same thing, no matter what time of day, what name tag I'm wearing, what hat I've got on. Like, that's what motivates me.
Yeah.
No apologies.
It's an exciting time for you.
Yeah. Yeah. But like the next 17 years is going to be exciting, right? Like,
right.
That's my point is how freeing to give yourself over to reconsidering what your next thing, what, like, my North Star hasn't changed. Right. What I'm moving towards in life has not changed. Never once has that wavered. But the pathway that I picture to that North Star has changed a million times. And I long ago accepted that, like, that doesn't make it harder to figure out my next steps. That makes it more exciting, and it means there's more opportunity than I have the ability to envision right now. Mm-hmm. And how wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's an exciting time. But, like, next year will be exciting, and the decade
That's
after
right.
that is, like,
That's
it's
right.
all exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I gave myself over to a higher power and a broader design a long time ago, mm-hmm. and that was really... Like, I had a falling out with my faith. So there was a really, like, challenging moment where I was like, I almost never get what I want when I want it. But I have always gotten what I needed when I needed it.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Wow.
And like, there's real moments in my life where, like, by the grace of God, that thing happened, that, like the rent got paid somehow, yeah. some way, the thing that, you know? And so, yeah, like a belief that I will always have what I need. It helps you rest easier at night when you believe that, and I do fundamentally believe that. And I gave up on having to figure out when I was going to get the thing I wanted or why I got this need met in that way, which was not the way I wanted it met. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and without fail, those answers have come back to me with perfect clarity, sometimes a decade later.
Wow.
So, like, there's questions I hold now that I'm like, oh, I can't wait for 55-year-old Shannon to have the wisdom about what the answer is to this one. But I'm going to believe.
Yeah.
And I've never, you know, it was like, there's questions that are still not answered for me. But, man, I've got such a long history of questions that came around with a good answer. Not what I would have called the right one at the time. Not mm-hmm. the one I wanted, but a good answer. And sometimes decades later.
But you know it's coming.
Yeah, but I do. Yeah. And I'm a better person because of, like, you know that Garth. So I grew up in the era of Garth Brooks,
sure.
like the first time. And the whole unanswered prayer song. Like, yeah. Yeah, there's plenty of, like, well, that was, thank goodness you didn't give me what I wanted in that moment. How, what a dodge. Like, how, I
right.
saved myself in that
right.
that thing not happening the way I wanted. So, yeah, just keep your eye on the North Star and be excited about what comes next. Thank you.